Epilogue. Bannon and Trump. On a sweltering morning in October 2017, the man who had more or less single-handedly brought about the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord stood on the steps of the Breitbart townhouse and said with a hearty laugh, "I guess global warming is real." Steve Bannon had lost 20 pounds since his exit from the White House 6 weeks before. He was on a crash all-sushi diet. "That building," said his friend David Bossie, speaking about all White Houses, but especially the Trump White House, "takes perfectly healthy people and turns them into old, unhealthy people." But Bannon, who Bossie had declared on virtual life support during his final days in the West Wing, was again, by his own description, on fire. He had moved out of the Arlington safe house and reestablished himself back at the Breitbart embassy, turning it into a headquarters for the next stage of the Trump movement, which might not include Trump at all. Asked about Trump's leadership of the nationalist populist movement, Bannon registered a not inconsiderable change in the country's political landscape. "I am the leader of the national populist movement." One cause of Bannon's boast and new resolve was that Trump, for no reason that Bannon could quite divine, had embraced Mitch McConnell's establishment candidate in the recent Republican runoff in Alabama, rather than support the Nat Pop choice for the Senate seat vacated by now Attorney General Jeff Sessions. After all, McConnell and the president were barely on speaking terms. From his August working holiday in Bedminster, the president's staff had tried to organize a makeup meeting with McConnell, but McConnell's staff had sent back word that it wouldn't be possible because the Senate leader would be getting a haircut. But the president, ever hurt and confused by his inability to get along with the congressional leadership, and then conversely enraged by their refusal to get along with him, had gone all in for the McConnell-backed Luther Strange, who had run against Bannon's candidate, the right-wing firebrand Roy Moore. Even by Alabama standards, Moore was far right. He had been removed as Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court for defying a federal court order to take down a monument of the Ten Commandments in the Alabama Judicial Building. For Bannon, the president's political thinking had been obtuse at best. He was unlikely to get anything from McConnell, and indeed, Trump had demanded nothing for his support for Luther Strange, which came via an unplanned tweet in August. Strange's prospects were not only dim, but he was likely to lose in a humiliating fashion. Roy Moore was the clear candidate of the Trump base, and he was Bannon's candidate. Hence, that would be the contest, Trump against Bannon. In fact, the president really didn't have to support anyone. No one would have complained if he'd stayed neutral in a primary race, or he could have tacitly supported Strange and not doubled down with more and more insistent tweets. For Bannon, this episode was not only about the president's continuing and curious confusion about what he represented, but about his mercurial, intemperate, and often cockamamie motivations. Against all political logic, Trump had supported Luther Strange, he told Bannon, because Luther's my friend. He said it like a 9-year-old, said Bannon, recoiling and noting that there was no universe in which Trump and Strange were actually friends. For every member of the White House senior staff, this would be the lasting conundrum of dealing with President Trump, the why of his often baffling behavior. "The president fundamentally wants to be liked," was Katie Walsh's analysis. "He just fundamentally needs to be liked so badly that it's always, everything is a struggle for him." This translated into a constant need to win something, anything. Equally important, it was essential that he look like a winner. Of course, trying to win without consideration, plan, or clear goals had, in the course of the administration's first 9 months, resulted in almost nothing but losses. At the same time, confounding all political logic, that lack of a plan, that impulsivity, that apparent joie de guerre had helped create the disruptiveness that seemed to so joyously shatter the status quo for so many. But now, Bannon thought, that novelty was finally wearing off. For Bannon, the Strange Moore race had been a test of the Trump cult of personality, Certainly Trump continued to believe that people were following him, that he was the movement, and that his support was worth 8 to 10 points in any race. Bannon had decided to test this thesis and to do so as dramatically as possible. All told, the Senate Republican leadership and others spent $32 million on Strange's campaign, while Moore's campaign spent $2 million. Trump, though aware of Strange's deep polling deficit, had agreed to extend his support in a personal trip. But his appearance in Huntsville, Alabama on September 22nd, before a Trump-sized crowd, was a political flatliner. It was a full-on Trump speech, 90 minutes of rambling and improvisation. The wall would be built. Now it was a see-through wall. Russian interference in the U.S. election was a hoax. He would fire anybody on his cabinet who supported Moore. But while his base turned out en masse, still drawn to Trump, the novelty, his cheerleading for Luther Strange drew at best a muted response. As the crowd became restless, the event threatened to become a hopeless embarrassment. Reading his audience and desperate to find a way out, Trump suddenly threw out a line about Colin Kaepernick's taking to his knee while the national anthem played at a National Football League game. The line got a standing ovation. The president thereupon promptly abandoned Luther Strange for the rest of the speech. Likewise, for the next week, he continued to whip the NFL. Pay no attention to Strange's resounding defeat 5 days after the event in Huntsville. Ignore the size and scale of Trump's rejection and the Moore Bannon triumph with its hint of new disruptions to come. Now Trump had a new topic, and a winning one. The knee. The fundamental premise of nearly everybody who joined the Trump White House was, this can work. We can help make this work. Now, only 3/4 of the way through just the first year of Trump's term, there was literally not one member of the senior staff who could any longer be confident of that premise. Arguably, and on many days indubitably, most members of the senior staff believed that the sole upside of being part of the Trump White House was to help prevent worse from happening. In early October, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's fate was sealed, if his obvious ambivalence toward the president had not already sealed it, by the revelation that he had called the president a fucking moron. This, insulting Donald Trump's intelligence, was both the thing you could not do and the thing, drawing there but for the grace of God guffaws across the senior staff, that everybody was guilty of. Everyone, in his or her own way, struggled to express the baldly obvious fact that the president did not know enough, did not know what he didn't know, did not particularly care, and, to boot, was confident if not serene in his unquestioned certitudes. There was now a fair amount of back-of-the-classroom giggling about who had called Trump what. For Steve Mnuchin and Reince Priebus, he was an idiot. For Gary Cohn, he was dumb as shit. For H.R. McMaster, he was a dope. The list went on. Tillerson would merely become yet another example of a subordinate who believed that his own abilities could somehow compensate for Trump's failings. Aligned with Tillerson were the three generals, Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly, each seeing themselves as representing maturity, stability, and restraint. And each, of course, was resented by Trump for it. The suggestion that any or all of these men might be more focused and even tempered than Trump himself was cause for sulking and tantrums on the president's part. The daily discussion among senior staffers, those still there and those now gone, all of whom had written off Tillerson's future in the Trump administration, was how long General Kelly would last as chief of staff. There was something of a virtual office pool, and the joke was that Reince Priebus was likely to be Trump's longest-serving chief of staff. Kelly's distaste for the president was open knowledge. In his every word and gesture, he condescended to Trump. The president's distaste for Kelly even more so. It was sport for the president to defy Kelly, who had become the one thing in his life he had never been able to abide, a disapproving and censorious father figure. There really were no illusions at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Kelly's long-suffering antipathy toward the president was rivaled only by his scorn for the president's family. Kushner, he pronounced, was insubordinate. Cohn's derisive contempt for Kushner as well as the president was even greater. In return, the president heaped more abuse on Cohn. The former president of Goldman Sachs was now a complete idiot, dumber than dumb. In fact, the president had also stopped defending his own family, wondering when they would take the hint and go home. But of course, this was still politics. Those who could overcome shame or disbelief, and despite all Trumpian coarseness and absurdity, suck up to him and humor him, might achieve unique political advantage. As it happened, few could. By October, however, many of the president's staff took particular notice of one of the few remaining Trump opportunists, Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador. Haley, as ambitious as a Lucifer in the characterization of one member of the senior staff, had concluded that Trump's tenure would last at best a single term and that she, with requisite submission, could be his heir apparent. Haley had courted and befriended Ivanka, and Ivanka had brought her into the family circle where she had become a particular focus of Trump's attention, and he of hers. Haley, as had become increasingly evident to the wider foreign policy and national security team, was the family's pick for Secretary of State after Rex Tillerson's inevitable resignation. Likewise, in this shuffle, Dina Powell would replace Haley at the UN. The president had been spending a notable amount of private time with Haley on Air Force One and was seen to be grooming her for a national political future. Haley, who was much more of a traditional Republican, one with a pronounced moderate streak, a type increasingly known as a Jervanka Republican, was, evident to many, being mentored in Trumpian ways. The danger here, offered one senior Trumper, is that she is so much smarter than him. What now existed, even before the end of the president's first year, was an effective power vacuum. The president, in his failure to move beyond daily chaos, had hardly seized the day. But, as sure as politics, someone would. In that sense, the Trumpian and Republican future was already moving beyond this White House. There was Bannon, working from the outside and trying to take over the Trump movement. There was the Republican leadership in Congress, trying to stymie Trumpism, if not slay it. There was John McCain, doing his best to embarrass it. There was the special counsel's office, pursuing the president and many of those around him. The stakes were very clear to Bannon. Haley, quite an un-Trumpian figure, but by far the closest of any of his cabinet members to him, might, with clever political wiles, entice Trump to hand her the Trumpian revolution. Indeed, fearing Haley's hold on the president, Bannon's side had, the very morning that Bannon had stood on the steps of the Breitbart townhouse in the unseasonable October weather, gone into overdrive to push the CIA's Mike Pompeo for state after Tillerson's departure. This was all part of the next stage of Trumpism, to protect it from Trump. General Kelly was conscientiously and grimly trying to purge the West Wing chaos. He had begun by compartmentalizing the sources and nature of the chaos. The overriding source, of course, was the president's own eruptions, which Kelly could not control and had resigned himself to accepting. As for the ancillary chaos, much of it had been calmed by the elimination of Bannon, Priebus, Scaramucci, and Spicer, with the effect of making it quite a Jervanka-controlled West Wing. Now, 9 months in, the administration faced the additional problem that it was very hard to hire anyone of stature to replace the senior people who had departed. And the stature of those who remained seemed to be more diminutive by the week. Hope Hicks, at 28, and Stephen Miller, at 32, both of whom had begun as effective interns on the campaign, were now among the senior-most figures in the White House. Hicks had assumed command of the communications operation, and Miller had effectively replaced Bannon as the senior political strategist. After the Scaramucci fiasco and the realization that the position of communications director would be vastly harder to fill, Hicks was assigned the job as the interim director. She was given the interim title partly because it seemed implausible that she was qualified to run an already battered messaging operation, and partly because if she was given the permanent job, everyone would assume that the president was effectively calling the daily shots. But by the middle of September, interim was quietly converted to permanent. In the larger media and political world, Miller, who Bannon referred to as my typist, was a figure of ever-increasing incredulity. He could hardly be taken out in public without engaging in some screwball, if not screeching, fit of denunciation and grievance. He was the de facto crafter of policy and speeches, and yet up until now he had largely only taken dictation. Most problematic of all, Hicks and Miller, along with everyone on the Gervonka side, were now directly connected to actions involved in the Russian investigation or efforts to spin it, deflect it, or indeed cover it up. Miller and Hicks had drafted, or at least typed, Kushner's version of the first letter written at Bedminster to fire Comey. Hicks had joined with Kushner and his wife to draft on Air Force One the Trump-directed press release about Don Jr. and Kushner's meeting with the Russians in Trump Tower. In its way, this had become the defining issue for the White House staff. Who had been in what inopportune room? And even beyond the general chaos, the constant legal danger formed part of the high barrier to getting people to come work in the West Wing. Kushner and his wife, now largely regarded as a time bomb inside the White House, were spending considerable time on their own defense and battling a sense of mounting paranoia, not least about what members of the senior staff who had already exited the West Wing might now say about them. Kushner, in the middle of October, would curiously add to his legal team Charles Harder, the libel lawyer who had defended both Hulk Hogan in his libel suit against Gawker, the internet gossip site, and Melania Trump in her suit against the Daily Mail. The implied threat to media and to critics was clear. Talk about Jared Kushner at your peril. It also likely meant that Donald Trump was yet managing the White House's legal defense, slotting in his favorite tough guy lawyers. Beyond Donald Trump's own daily antics, here was the consuming issue of the White House, the ongoing investigation directed by Robert Mueller. The father, the daughter, the son-in-law, his father, the extended family exposure, the prosecutor, the retainers looking to save their own skins, the staffers who Trump had rewarded with the back of his hand, it all threatened, in Bannon's view, to make Shakespeare look like Dr. Seuss. Everyone waited for the dominoes to fall and to see how the president, in his fury, might react and change the game again. Steve Bannon was telling people he thought there was a 33.3% chance that the Mueller investigation would lead to the impeachment of the president, a 33.3% chance that Trump would resign, perhaps in the wake of a threat by the cabinet to act on the 25th Amendment, by which the cabinet can remove the president in the event of his incapacitation, and a 33.3% chance that he would limp to the end of his term. In any event, there would certainly not be a second term or even an attempt at one. "He's not going to make it," said Bannon at the Breitbart embassy. "He's lost his stuff." Less volubly, Bannon was telling people something else. He, Steve Bannon, was going to run for president in 2020. The locution, "if I were president," was turning into "when I am president." The top Trump donors from 2016 were in his camp, Bannon claimed. Sheldon Adelson, the Mercers, Bernie Marcus, and Peter Thiel. In short order, and as though he had been preparing for this move for some time, Bannon had left the White House and quickly thrown together a rump campaign organization. The heretofore behind-the-scenes Bannon was methodically meeting with every conservative leader in the country, doing his best, as he put it, to kiss the ass and pay homage to all the graybeards, and he was keynoting a list of must-attend conservative events. "Why is Steve speaking? I didn't know he spoke," the president remarked with puzzlement and rising worry to aides. Trump had been upstaged in other ways as well. He had been scheduled for a major 60 Minutes interview in September, but this was abruptly canceled after Bannon's 60 Minutes interview with Charlie Rose on September 11th. The president's advisors felt he shouldn't put himself in a position where he would be compared with Bannon. The worry among staffers, all of them concerned that Trump's rambling and his alarming repetitions, the same sentences delivered with the same expression minutes apart, had significantly increased, and that his ability to stay focused, never great, had notably declined, was that he was likely to suffer by such a comparison. Instead, the interview with Trump was offered to Sean Hannity with a preview of the questions. Bannon was also taking the Breitbart Opposition Research Group, the same forensic accountant types who had put together the damning Clinton cash revelations, and focusing it on what he characterized as the political elites. This was a catch-all list of enemies that included as many Republicans as Democrats. Most of all, Bannon was focused on fielding candidates for 2018. While the president had repeatedly threatened to support primary challenges against his enemies, in the end, with his aggressive head start, it was Bannon who would be leading these challenges. It was Bannon spreading fear in the Republican Party, not Trump. Indeed, Bannon was willing to pick outre, if not wacky, candidates, including former Staten Island Congressman Michael Grimm, who had done a stint in federal prison, to demonstrate, as he had demonstrated with Trump, the scale, artfulness, and menace of Bannon-style politics. Although the Republicans in the 2018 congressional races were looking, according to Bannon's numbers, at a 15-point deficit, it was Bannon's belief that the more extreme the right-wing challenge appeared, the more likely the Democrats would field left-wing nutters even less electable than right-wing nutters. The disruption had just begun. Trump, in Bannon's view, was a chapter, or even a detour, in the Trump revolution, which had always been about weaknesses in the two major parties. The Trump presidency, however long it lasted, had created the opening that would provide the true outsiders their opportunity. Trump was just the beginning. Standing on the Breitbart steps that October morning, Bannon smiled and said, "It's going to be wild as shit." This is Holter Graham. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2018 by Michael Wolff.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.